Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show. It's Culture Time. I'm Hemel.
Hi. Hi, listeners. I'm Brian.
What were we here to talk about?
We were here to talk about the death of Ursula Le Guin and science fiction as an informer of the popular culture. And then you keep talking about A Wrinkle in Time.
The reason that I wanted to talk about this is because in a lot of just our conversations that don't happen in podcast format, you have mentioned how much you like her stuff. You wrote an entire blog post about science fiction books that you should read.
Yeah.
And wasn't it entirely about...
For a while, like a couple years ago, I was like, oh, you know what? I don't have a blog anymore. I should write stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
And I didn't ever do it. And I think the first thing I tried to write was like, oh, I'm going to put my five... Because I was thinking like, what am I into that other people might be into? And like science fiction writing is a big one. And I was like, oh, Ursula Le Guin, my favorite. I love her.
Yes.
I'm going to write like my five favorite books of hers and why people should read them. And that was the only thing I ever wrote on the internet. And then I dug it up when she died and I, you know, was like, oh, she died. And I put this back out. And a lot of people that I know, you know, work and friends were like, oh, yeah, I saw that thing. That's so great. I kept hearing from people like, oh, I've heard about her. I think actually, you know, she was in the news because she'd passed away. And what I kept hearing from people was like, oh, I don't really like science fiction. And I found myself saying, like, oh, that's okay. You'll like her. It's not really science fiction-y. And every time I said that, I was like, oh, what I really want to do is launch into a 10-minute diatribe about the literature of the fantastic. But I don't want to alienate every single person. I don't want to alienate this person standing next to me in the mailroom.
So what do you mean? Because I am 100% those people that were like, oh, I always meant to read her, but I never got into it. And I wanted to talk to you about it because you seem like such a big fan and you have such a history, not just with this, with that author, but within science fiction. Like, you're very well read in that entire genre.
Yeah, that's very much my jam. The thing is, like, I could go deep on this topic and it would be of zero interest to any human being, much less anyone who might happening to be listening.
So let me rephrase this question, because I want to talk about A Wrinkle in Time too, but I think that these things kind of tie in together. What is it that drew you to her work first?
So if you're into, like, the ways that science fiction differs from, I would say, mainstream fiction, and really, like, science fiction, fantasy, horror, they're just marketing categories, right? Like, it's all literature of the fantastic, right? Mm-hmm. Writing about something that could not or would not happen. And I would say I was thinking about this on the train here, it's like, well, what sets that apart? And I would say it's, one, world creation, right?
Yes.
I mean, every fictional author creates a world for you, right? There's an author I like, Muhsin Hamid. I just finished one of his books, and it's set in called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. Like, it was on all the list a few years ago. It's written in the second person completely, which is badass. So you should check that out. But it's set in Lahore, and I'm never going to go to Lahore. I've never been to Lahore. But he creates that world for the reader in the book. So
to be able to pull it off in the second person is a huge feat.
Yeah,
yes.
Never breaks.
No.
I've never been there. I'm not going to go there, but I totally got the setting when I was there. But he wasn't creating Lahore. He was conveying it to me.
Right.
So in a science fiction world, in a fantastic world, the author has to create the world and make it believable enough that they can then convey it. And I think there are, like, Tolkien made this, to me, I will go to the mat to defend J.R.R. Tolkien as, like, a literary master for this idea of, like, you can create a world and have it be so deep and so real that you could set these sort of historical myths in it. Or, like, Dune, which is a science fiction classic. And if you haven't read Dune, you should read it just to, like, it will blow your mind what somebody can come up with. You're laughing at me.
I'm not laughing at you. I totally know what you mean, because successful world creation launches fans and fandom, right? You got Harry Potter fans because she did such a great job building that world,
right,
of creating Harry and the whole system of magic and the muggles and the wizards. And it's all stuff that when you think about it, it makes total sense. But she had to pull it out of thin air.
Right.
So, yes, I totally understand world creation.
So that appeals to me enormously as a reader. Right. Mm-hmm. I love to get into someone else's world and just see what the human mind can do. But I would say the other thing that science fiction does, and Ursula Le Guin is not a world creator. She does not spend a lot of time on the geography or the names of the society of these imaginary worlds she creates. Where I think science fiction, and she is the queen of this, is the idea of metaphor, right? Like, you can explore a topic and not, you know, aliens and robots aren't writing this or reading this. It's still about human beings. You can explore a topic from a completely different angle by refracting it through a science fiction world, like through an imaginary world. And, like, I would say her big themes are, like, she writes a lot about colonialism. She writes a lot about family structure and human sexuality, but she will invent a different way to look at it, right? Like, probably my favorite book of hers is the book called The Left Hand of Darkness. And the main character is like a normal human from Earth who is sent like as an envoy from this galactic federation. And again, she doesn't care about those details, so she doesn't get into him. And he's on this planet where the entire population is asexual. They have no secondary sexual characteristics. And once a month, they will go into this state where they will develop male or female characteristics based on who they happen to be with. So one person could give birth or father a child. So because of the way their sexuality works, they don't have any sexist structures or misogynist structures because they don't have that kind of tension in their lives. And they look at this human man from Earth as being, like, he makes them uncomfortable because he's constantly in what to them is this, like, unnatural state, and he is continually misunderstanding what's happening around him, like politically and socially, because he's so locked in this idea of male and female interaction that does not exist in this world. And that is a completely made-up thing. It's not real, but she's exploring how men and women interact with each other in our society by refracting it through this lens. And to me, that is what is one of the things that is most powerful about science fiction and something that she does probably better than anybody.
I have never read her, but I think it's because her work always seemed to, I don't want to say esoteric, but she was always so high in that canon that it didn't feel like it would be fun to read.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And that's the problem is that, if I'm picking this up, it feels like work.
Yeah, it's going to be some sort of political treatise. Yeah. And that's what people like me do that to other people. Like, you know, The Wire?
Yeah.
Like, I know people are like, I don't want to watch The Wire. The truth is The Wire is like a really watchable show. You finish one episode and you're like, oh my God, I got to see what happens to this character. But the way like people, like annoying Wire fans talk about it, it's, oh my God, it's a commentary on the American urban infrastructure. Like, we talk about that kind of stuff. And the same with Ursula Le Guin, right? You talk about it as like, oh, she's addressing the legacy of colonialism. But even the book I just talked about, it's a great, like, adventure story. It's a, like, friendship story. Like, this human guy and this other character, they're on this journey across this glacier. And the other character, at one point, goes through that state, and she becomes a woman. And all of a sudden, this person who he's kind of seen as a man, because that's how he sees things, is a woman. And it freaks them both out. Like, there's a lot of the amazing stuff in all of her writing, and it's just really readable and entertaining.
So, what about her legacy? Is that hard to really put into? I mean, it feels like she lived long enough to see her legacy cemented.
Yeah,
right?
Totally. Like, just in the last few years, she's been
canonized.
Yeah, like, and I love that as a fan of this kind of writing, which has been, like, sort of, like, ghettoized and looked down on. And I feel like, really, yeah, just in the last 5 years, people have looked at genre writing as more like, oh, this is just great writing. Yeah, and I feel like she was one of the beneficiaries of that. And she was a woman writing in like a really male-dominated area. And she also wasn't trying to write like, you know, spaceships and, you know, laser cannons and like there's this
Star Wars stuff.
Yeah, she wasn't trying. She was just doing like she writes like from the perspective of a feminist and an anarchist and an anthropologist. There's this device she has in kind of her, like she has this very loose, like sort of shared universe, but she wasn't trying to do that. She didn't care.
Yeah.
And she wanted her characters to be able to talk across sort of like galactic distances. So she invented this thing like that lets them talk, but she doesn't try to explain how it works. And in an interview, she's like, it doesn't matter. I don't care. Like it's a narrative device and she doesn't pretend it's something else. So I think that not only does she have this like really powerful legacy as a writer, she did it very much on her own terms. You know, as a feminist at a time when, like, she started writing in, like, the 60s. And, like, who was, you know, an out feminist writer back then?
There aren't any. I mean, I know just from everything that I read about her and around her, so much of her legacy had to do with not just her work, but the space that she occupied in that genre.
Yeah,
is that she
totally.
Had to be, she had to break boundaries. And there were all kinds of things where she became kind of this person to me that, even without knowing her work, I'm trying to think of a comparable author, but it was more that you knew more about her story, even if you hadn't read her work.
Yeah, I think Joan Didion, I'm trying to think of like a mainstream literary figure.
Yeah, I always think about Anais Nin in that sense too, is that she's like, I've never really read a lot of her work, but you very much know the cult of personality. And Ursula Le Guin was like that.
Yeah, there's a quote, I don't remember how to properly attribute it, but it's a quote by a woman science fiction writer writing today when it's not a big thing, and writing like, oh, we're all writing in the shadow that she cast. Like, the things that she wrote back then inform what we do now in ways that we don't even think about. Oh, and also, so this idea, ideas of like feminism and human sexuality, but also her politics were really radical. Like, she called herself an anarchist. One of her best books, one of my favorites, is a book called The Dispossessed. Go read that one. Everyone listening, if you haven't read it, after you read Left Hand of Darkness, go read The Dispossessed. After you watch Cool Runnings. Those are the three things. Watch Cool Runnings in the middle, I guess. Take a little break from the books. But like, I feel like we're at a movie time now where the first time in my entire adult life, this idea of challenging capitalism, challenging like democratic capital, like all of the structures that we have assumed our whole lives are immovable, are suddenly revealed to maybe not be immovable. But she was writing about like, what does a society look like that is not capitalist, that is also not a historical analog of like the Soviet Union or something, right? She was writing about like, what would an anarchist society be like? And like, again, she's not writing polemic. She's not a political writer. She's telling stories. So you get a character that you love doing things that are interesting, but it gets set against the backdrop where after you're done, you have this new idea in your head. Like, you have this new thought technology that you did not hitherto have access to.
And this is what makes her so, I don't want to say off-putting, but it makes her so intimidating to read.
I think a lot of people, and you're probably this kind of person, like, I do not want to read about a bunch of robots and space Martians.
I do want to read about robots and space Martians. Well, wow, you're so sexist, Brian.
No, I didn't mean you as a woman. I just meant you as someone who doesn't read a lot of science fiction.
I don't read any.
But her characters are all human, and there's no robots, and there's no space Martians. They're just human who she's putting them through. She's putting them in a place where she can sort of look at our society in a different way by putting these very normal, very relatable human beings in what are strange and unusual situations.
Yeah, it's grounded in a very emotional reality, which is what makes good science fiction, good fantasy, all of that work, is that the problems are very common. One of the things that I thought was interesting is this comparison, which is that A Wrinkle in Time was pretty much written around the same time.
Yeah, it's from the 60s.
It's from the 60s. Where she was publishing, but they're not in the same league at all, right? Wrinkle in Time is a children's book.
Yes.
But, and if you're not familiar with A Wrinkle in Time, are you familiar with it?
You know, I am familiar with A Wrinkle in Time. I went back, I worked at a great nonprofit called First Book. Check them out, send them $50. A few years ago when A Wrinkle in Time had its 25th anniversary, mm-hmm. and its publisher, I want to say was Macmillan, sent like a warehouse full of these books, which was great. And I was like, well, I gotta read this one again. And I could not get back into it. It did not hold up.
Okay. Before we talk about whether or not it holds up, because I agree with you.
For those who have not read the book, though.
But for those who have not read the book, it's about a young girl who travels through different planets and dimensions and has to go rescue her father from being captured, who has been captured by this one big giant brain that controls this crazy dark planet. It's very trippy, where everybody thinks the same and does everything the same. And the minute you step out of line, you know, they come take you away for free and independent thought.
Also, she has a weird little brother.
She has a very smart little brother.
Yes.
Charles Wallace. It's tackling the same kind of problems that you're talking about that Ursula Le Guin does, in that it like is a metaphor for communism, and she's almost weirdly libertarian in like the individual freedom that
yes,
she's,
you're right. There's a little of an
there's
Ayn
a little
Randian
Ayn
vibe
Rand
there.
In there, yeah, because she talks very very much about how much you know, society should just be about the individual and free expression and stuff like that. And
I think she's coming from the hippie side of libertarianism.
She's coming from the hippie side, but there's a little bit of Ayn Rand in there, trust me, because he's like pretty anti-government when it come down to it. The science fiction that you're describing seems like a natural progression and stepping stone for like young readers who might have started out with A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, you can't start people off reading Dune when they're 7 years or 12 years old. You
right.
have to read, yeah.
This was, I came to this as a 10-year-old, and they're going to make this a movie that's coming out shortly with like Reese Witherspoon and my favorite Chris Pine as the dad.
And Oprah.
I was getting to Oprah.
Sorry. I got excited.
And Mindy Kaling. But I was very excited when I heard that it was going to become a movie.
It looks cool.
I reread the book, and I agree with you. I don't think it holds up.
Yeah. It doesn't hold up.
It does not hold up. There's a lot of different reasons. One, the heroine that they created in the 60s is wildly out of date for a contemporary young person because she whines a lot. Like, she's very if you're a young reader and you've grown up with like the Hunger Games,
right.
And you
Katniss Everdeen,
Katniss Everdeen,
people in the
who
eye.
Just like knows how to handle her shit. This is a young woman who's like still coming into her own power and is very insecure and very shy. And so she spends a lot of the book whining. She spends a
Which
lot
is
of
probably
the book,
more realistic than Katniss Everdeen shooting
yeah,
people in the eye.
But she spends a lot of the book, you know, running around being unsure of herself and not figuring out what to do. and constantly leaning on like the men in her life. And she kind of gets through it in the end. But I don't think it's a book that, I don't know how well it would resonate with readers today.
And also, we alluded earlier to this idea of like world creation. Like you have to create an alternate world that doesn't really exist and sell it to the reader. And it has to have internal consistency. It can't feel like just made up jibber jabber. Mm-hmm. The world of A Wrinkle in Time, I feel like, is a little bit made up jibber jabber, right? Like, new things pop up as the plot calls for them, rather than feeling like
they're organic.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's the world creation is okay, but what I liked about it as a young reader, and I loved it as a kid, loved it to the point where I like quoted it in journals that I kept in college. Like, that's how much I loved it.
So you were a reader of the fantastic once upon a time in your wholesome
youth.
Well,
this is kind of what I wanted to get to, is like that disconnect that happens between like how, why do some people not make that leap?
Because it's beaten out of us, right? Like at some point, and you're an English major, right? Like you were someone
major.
Who like, I'm going to take literature seriously. Yeah. We were told that this was not a kind of literature to take seriously.
Yes. It wasn't taught to me, but a lot of it is also, and I don't want to get into specific gender, but I'm just going to talk about me. Part of the appeal of Wrinkle in Time
is... Hemel is a woman, for those of you who can't see her or tell.
Part of the appeal is that this is a young girl who is kind of navigating these issues. And especially when you're a young female reader, all the books that you're given are either about like your friends or your family... Or
sure,
puberty,
right?
There's not a lot else out there.
Those are the topics.
Those are the topics that you will be covering as a young female reader. So Wrinkle in Time is like crazy. It's an adventure story. She's going on adventures, kind of like Little House on the Prairie, until she starts dating that farmer guy.
I have no idea what you're talking about now.
There's a big gap between that kind of novel for like young adults to like be able to lead you on that path. Like if I'm looking for more things like Wrinkle in Time, there weren't that many when you're growing up. You kind of had to jump straight to the Ursula Le Guin.
You know, she wrote a young adult series that is fantastic. It's called A Wizard of Earthsea. It has a school for wizards from like 40 years ago. Check it out, Harry Potter fans. But she, like, the main character is a boy. And she talked about that later, and she was like, you know, it just never occurred to me that the main character would be a girl. Like, she wrote this in the 60s, and of course, it's an adventure story. It's going to have a male protagonist.
It's going to have a male protagonist. Yeah, there's not a lot to make that stepping stone. So whatever faults that A Wrinkle in Time has,
I just don't think... Madeline L'Engle had her on there.
It maybe has not aged very well in, like, the 50 years that it's been, which is fine. It still has a lot to recommend it.
Or some other... The literature of the fantastic you enjoyed before it was beaten out of you by the Academy.
There was this weird book that I loved. I think it was called Alpha Something, and it was about a young boy who was going to go visit his family, but they lived way, way in the future where your consciousness was just implanted into different bodies. So, like, your body slept here, and then your, like, little chip was inserted into a different body somewhere, and he was trying to figure out somewhere down the line, you know, one of his parents had been lost. Or swapped out. So he knew that the person that looked like his dad wasn't exactly his dad, and he was trying to find his real dad. But I remember the whole conceit of people's consciousness being transferred from like to just different bodies.
Prophetic.
Blew my mind. I remember that was a great book. What about you?
Oh God, it was, you know, that's all. That was at one point that was all I read. Like I was probably at college age before I like even started exploring writing that was not science fiction and fantasy and horror.
I mean, as I got older, especially as a young like female reader, you get steered to the Judy Blumes and the Lois Lowrys, which were all good books, but there just was not a lot of fantasy stuff, like science fiction fantasy stuff. I think as a kid, I would have loved The Hunger Games. I have not read them now. I've heard they're very good.
They're very readable.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, they're not going to go down in history.
But again, it's the world building. That is what people really find.
Although I do think that, like, with most, like, Hunger Games or Game of Thrones, the world building is serviceable, right? It's not, if you really, like, an anthropologist couldn't get in and root around and, like, find some depth. It's just like, oh, it's an analog of, like everyone knows the world of the Game of Thrones, but it's really just these are like, this is kind of the Viking people and these are kind of the Spanish people. Like they're all analogs of real world cultures we know. That is a really handy cognitive shortcut that I think a lot of, if not most, science fiction fantasy writers lean on, and the ones who do not, the ones who create something that is genuinely alien and new, that's what I'm really drawn to.
Well, that, in because it's so much easier for readers to slip into a world when it's just like something that they know, but only slightly different.
You know what to think. You know who those people are.
Yeah, it already feels comfortable versus these people don't have a gender. Like, that's shocking, right?
That's where you're really getting the good stuff,
yeah,
though.
How do I feel comfortable in that world?
No. I wish I could read something now. Like, Watership Down was one of my all-time favorites. I loved it as a kid. I've probably read it a dozen times. There's passages from that book, chapters that I could still, like, I still read the last 100 pages of that book in one sitting because I can't put it down because I'm so excited. But I don't think if I encountered it now as an adult, I would have the same response to it. I think, like, it's impossible for me to love a book the way I love the books that I first read as a young person.
I'm trying to think if there's other books like that when I was a young kid.
Have you read Watership Down?
I never read it.
Oh my God! You haven't seen Cool Runnings, you haven't read Watership Down. This podcast is over.
Are you never coming back on this podcast?
I only want to talk about the culture of 35 to 40 years ago, apparently.
Brian Minter, thank you for being here.
Thank you. I've enjoyed being here. I want everyone to check out those authors I mentioned. There's no reason not to read everything they've ever written.
Yeah, people don't read enough. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time.